I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in Boston in 2004, a young politician named Barack Obama electrified the Democratic National Convention with these words.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
And we know what happened in 2008. Fast forward to this summer when Steve Bannon, who had a big hand in Donald Trump's win, said this about the Democrats. The longer they talk about identity politics, I got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. Hillary Clinton was criticized for focusing too much on identity groups as part of her political strategy. Well, leftists and liberals and Democrats have been debating how to win elections, how to win over and win back voters. And that's our topic for today's Radio Times. We have three guests who have joined us, including Imani Perry, sitting across from me in our Philadelphia studio. She's the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, author of three books, including More Beautiful and More Terrible, The Embrace and Transcendence of Racial Inequality in the United States. Imani Perry, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us by phone is Linda Hirschman. She writes about social movements. Her most recent book is Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. She's currently working on a book about abolition called Black and White. Linda Hirschman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Brianna Joy Gray joins us from the NPR studios in New York. She's a lawyer, co-host of the SWOTY podcast. She's written about politics for Current Affairs and Paste magazine, among others. And Brianna Joy Gray, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I must confess, I had to kind of wrestle this show to the ground, and I kept saying to producer John Ahrens, what are we going to talk about? But I think I have my hand on it. But Imani, let me start with you. When you talk about identity politics, what does that mean to you?
Well, it means a couple of different things, and based upon what it means, I think it tells us something about how to analyze it. So on one level, the critiques of identity politics are often from the left or that it displaces discussions of class inequality. And the critique from the right is that there's too much attention focused on these minority groups and not right on the rest of Americans. Although someone like Steve Bannon definitely is engaged in identity politics,
clearly,
or white nationalist identity politics. But I think for me, the way that they are useful is as an understanding that even economic outcomes are shaped to some large extent by identity categories, right? So if we think about things like wealth inequality, so for example, that the average high school graduate has more wealth than the average, you know, the black person who has an advanced degree, right? That's something that you can only get at if you're understanding race. Just income doesn't tell you that, right? And we could go, you know, there's multiple variations upon that theme. And so I think a useful form of identity politics is as a metric for understanding that there are actually quite distinct experiences in this society. On the basis of identity groups, it's not everything,
right?
But it is something.
So if you're African American or you're Hispanic or you're Asian or you're LGBTQ,
yes,
there are probably experiences that you have that are unique to your group.
Or if not unique, that are incredibly significant, right? So that, I mean, because I think there's lots of things around which there can be coalitions of understanding across various group identities, but certainly there are those identities impact. Now, the danger, I just say quickly,
sure,
the danger, though, is always that elites of each of those groups, particularly in the political process, overrepresent their interests and so maintain the status quo, and we just have a diverse group of elites as opposed to actually addressing inequality on a deep level.
I want to pick up on that. Let me give you a chance, Brianna, to weigh in, and I don't want to spend the whole hour talking about what is or what isn't identity politics, but it's a word that gets thrown around a lot and I think means different things to different people. How do you see that, Brianna?
Yes, I think Professor Perry is right to point out that there are two main ways that it's interpreted. And the problem is, the reason why I think there's been so much conflict in the media about whether or not we should be pro or against identity politics is because people are taking and using these two definitions separately. Yes, there are, of course, important disparities that cannot be seen using a class analysis alone. And race is important to make sure that those kind of disparities don't persist on a policy level. Of course, what people on the left are arguing about and what they're concerned about when they, for example, protest people like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker being pushed as another forerunner in 2020 is the idea that they suffer from a lot of the same kinds of criticisms that other white status quo enforcing candidates have had, and that their race is being used as a way to deflect those criticisms and deflect them from any legitimate judgment.
I mean, would you call them corporatists?
It's
a loaded word, but go ahead.
It's a loaded word, and I do try to stay away from some of those terms, even though I think that they're accurate. I think terms like neoliberal and corporatist are accurate descriptors, but in the interest of communicating more effectively, sure. I do try to avoid them.
Fair enough. Linda, let me get you in on the conversation. Is this an either-or discussion, that it's either identity politics or it's a economic class message?
No, because that's the wrong answer is what the wrong question produces. The idea that identity is everything that's not white men is a mistake. White men are an identity. Bannon was invoking that in the quotation that you used. And class is an identity. So it wasn't so long ago that when there were actually such things as labor unions, that people identified as working class. And that could be white male working class, the current favorite child of the media, or men and women in the working class of all races. So I think it's a mistake to use identity politics to mean that white male is the natural kind and everybody else is some kind of identity.
I wonder, though, whether, I mean, we are clearly a much more diverse country, as you said, Linda. I mean, we don't have unions the way we used to. And I just wonder whether the political landscape has changed so much is that we use identity politics as a kind of a fallback because things are such in flux. You're nodding your head at me, Imani.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the part of what excited people about the Sanders campaign was that there was actually a discussion, there was a revival of the language of the working class.
Right.
It had really been eradicated from, so people of across the, people from widely varying different economic circumstances would all call themselves middle class for decades in the United States, right? And so I do think that the kind of invisibility for so long of a robust processes. And these are, and to talk about, it's not just identity, but it's actually organization and social networks and what de Tocqueville called associational life in the United States that actually is ultimately, I think, what we're missing. So it is these categories do in some ways function as proxies because of relatively limited organizing around identities as such.
You know, Brianna, and to all three of you, it's interesting that Hillary Clinton's book is coming out and people have had some advanced copies. It's getting a fair amount of attention. She seems to be still pretty angry at Bernie Sanders. Really interesting piece in the New York Times today about it's almost like breakaway groups from the Democratic Party that want to create a more progressive message, perhaps even a more progressive movement. Brianna, do you see this as a fight within the Democratic Party, or is it something else?
It definitely feels like a fight within the Democratic Party, though I'm not sure that it needed to be that way. I think that there was hope among all of us on the progressive left that the party would be more responsive in the wake of Hillary's loss. But what we saw with the fight for who was going to control the DNC and a kind of ugly smear campaign against Ralph Ellison and kind of hesitance by many in Hillary's camp, including Hillary now with this book, to kind of own the failures of the campaign and to show an interest in moving forward and being responsive, you know, to the people who are still very much in favor of the Bernie coalition. Bernie Sanders continues to be the most popular politician in America and has the highest approval rating among Black Americans. And yet there's still this smear that persists, which pretends that the Bernie coalition is a white coalition, that it's comprised of Bernie bros. And it goes so far as to suggest that those who would be sympathetic to an economic message are themselves hostile to race and gender and other kinds of intersectionality. There's a lot of discussion of intersectionality, but that discussion doesn't seem to allow room for the intersection of class as another identity.
Linda, let me toss something to you that, I mean, we focus so much on presidential races, but to the detriment, I think, of races that are more sort of down on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I think over the last, or perhaps it was even during President Obama, something like 1,000 seats were lost in state legislatures and in local government, lost from the Democrats to the Republicans. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells you that the Democrats are, well, first of all, it was a terrible mistake, right? I mean, losing the election of 2010, which is the redistricting election, was the most serious loss that we have, that the left has experienced. So once you lost the election of 2010, it meant that the state legislatures and the Congress were all going to be redistricted largely by the right. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge and hugely important thing. It also, that loss and your question mm-hmm. also reflects the fact that the Democrats are a very unruly alliance. and it is a hard alliance to keep together. I think that and I think that a lot of these conversations are about that, because I know, speaking for myself, I am, you know, desperate that the losing not continue. Mm. So the question about how to keep enough of an alliance together to actually win elections, both at the presidential level and then all the way down to the city council, is, I think, a lot of what's driving this.
Well, let's take a very short break. I'm just looking at the clock here. Much more to talk about. We've got lots of people that want to join the conversation. The voice you just heard is Linda Hirschman. She's a writer, writes about social movements, wrote a book about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor called Sisters in Law, joining us by phone. Joining us from New York, from the NPR studios in New York, is Brianna Joy Gray. She's a lawyer, co-host of the Swody podcast, and we caught up with her when we read about some of her writings in Current Affairs and Paste magazine. And with me here in our Philadelphia studios is Imani Perry. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's finishing up one book. She's got another one that she's working on, and her most recent book is called More Beautiful and More Terrible, The Embrace and Transcendence of Racial Inequality in the United States. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Imani, let me toss this back to you. I'm not sure this entire conversation is about the Democratic Party. Right. I think mm-hmm. it's larger than that. But where would the Democratic Party be without Black women?
It would be quite a terrible state. So I think it's an important point, right? So that Black women are the most loyal constituency of the Democratic Party. And I think the point, I love the question because it connects to something that I think is really important to add to the conversation, which is often missing, which is, You know, elected representatives are supposed to represent the interests of their constituents. And I think consistently, and this is one of the important critiques of the Democratic Party, that consistently now there are the most loyal constituents are taken for granted, and there's always either a chasing of other voters or a chasing of corporate interests. And I think that that kind of critique is essential to levy because we have to begin to figure out how to make the Democratic Party accountable to the desires, the interests, the needs of their most loyal constituents. And this fear of being, I mean, you do see from the Democratic Party a fear of being attached too much to identity groups. And that, I think, I think that's a problem, along with redistricting, along with voter suppression, is how do you respond to these communities.
Brianna, and this is to all of you, I was saying as you all are talking, I'm also thinking that identity politics worked very well for Donald Trump.
Yes.
I mean, he that was really his message about the aggrieved white working class person who was afraid of immigrants and afraid of losing their job. And I mean, some of this stuff is very real, but that seemed to work for that seemed to work for him, at least in 2016. Why do you think that is a more effective message for him or perhaps even the Republican Party and more of a problem for the Democrats?
Well, for me, it felt like two things. One, that he wasn't solely relying on identity politics, although I think that was the focus of a lot of leftist criticism. You know, Donald Trump would say something about, you know, implying that Mexicans were rapists, and then go on to make an argument that they're stealing our jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's not true, but it is an economic argument tied in, you know, made exciting, made accessible by using, I can't even say dog whistling, just blatant racism. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, from the Democrats, we didn't get a contrasting, competing message, rather. And I think that we responded with pure identity politics. You know, that guy's a racist. We have a multiracial coalition. And that alone, without the economic tie-in, is what I feel like made Clinton's message not resonate.
What would that message have been if there had been an economic tie-in, Brianna?
I think it would have focused a lot more on unions. Having part of the problem is that Clinton, as a candidate, was kind of blocked from making some of the arguments that would have resonated with people, right? Because part of Trump's appeal was that, as much as he is a Wall Street mogul, he does present as an outsider. He was able to rely on his own money. He didn't have the claims of corporate buyout and corporate influence that Hillary had to contend with. And as a result, she couldn't quite play the every man's woman, you know, the way that Trump could. So I say that, yes, the Democrats needed more of an economic message. They needed more of a populist message. But, you know, Hillary in part was hamstringed from doing so, which is a lot of why a lot of us were concerned when Bernie didn't win the nomination.
Linda, do you? Go ahead.
Okay, let's concentrate on the white working class men who were really the voters that put Donald Trump in the White House and have also dominated the Congress and the state legislatures. White, less educated, mostly working class men are a perfect example of intersectionality. They are at the intersection of white and male and working class. And they have chosen, consciously or unconsciously, their identity as white men over their identity as working men. Many of the programs that the left puts forward, or even the center puts forward, about decent health care for everyone and a minimum wage of $15, to say nothing of the revival of the labor movement, would benefit working people of all colors and genders and sexual orientation. But these white men don't vote for those programs because their identity as white men trumps their working class identity. And the question about how to attract them back to the working class identity is the $64 question in today's politics.
And I know you want to say something, Imani, but let me just follow up with that, Linda. So if what you're saying is true, how do either Democrats or liberals or progressives or leftists, how do you then appeal to that identity of a white working class man?
So one of the things that you don't do is offer them the interests of your most faithful followers, as Brianna said. That's not what you do, right? You have to offer, you can't do that. You have to be faithful to your representational obligation to your faithful followers and find, which exists, it's not hard to find, economic programs that benefit both the black and white and male and female people who are on the short end of the economic deal. And you have to change the culture. This is not something that happens all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen with anodyne speeches about how we're all one America.
Hmm.
That's not true, and it's not helpful.
Well, and it's and it almost feels quaint and dated to hear Obama speaking in 2004.
I thought it was weird in 2004.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah,
I'm right.
But he won in 2008, so you know I'm not saying to do the other.
I get it, but remember, it was after the most disastrous term of an American president since Andrew Johnson.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I don't want to relive the past so much. But
No. But I mean, looking forward, I think that I'm writing about abolition right now. They started in 1829 with the worst opponent that you can have in this country. And it took 33 years, but eventually it did change.
Oh,
and I think you have to be hopeful and be liberal in the true sense of the word in making a message and starting to change the culture. The left only needs to scrape away a few votes. It wasn't a big victory.
Well, let me give Amani Perry a chance, and I'm sure, Brianna, you want to jump in as well.
The one thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that Trump won a majority of upper-class white male voters. He won a majority of middle-class white male voters. He won a majority of white women. So it's almost as though I think the popular discourse about the white working class is similar to the blaming of the white working class for racism, right? It's them, right? It's not. But the reality is that it was a wide swath of white America that supported Trump, notwithstanding the surveying suggesting that there was a great deal of disdain for him as a human being, which suggests that there's a lot of this that's about white racial anxiety, that it's about a fear of, the coming ethnic plurality as opposed to the nation being a majority white nation.
And willing to overlook some of these personality traits and comments.
Right. It is, so in terms of a culture shift, that means that we have an urgency in terms of how we think, not just about class, but about race.
Brianna, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that it's suspicious the extent to which it's working class and poor whites who are kind of vilified among all of those who voted for Trump. The Trump coalition is not substantively different than any Republican coalition that we've seen in the modern era.
Yes.
And yet there's this other rising of the Trump voter, which seems to suggest that we shouldn't talk to them, they can't be reached, they can't be shifted, even though we see that narrow margin Professor Perry is talking about is what cost Hillary the election. Those a few votes in the Midwest of people from districts that we saw that went once or even twice for Obama and then later for Trump. So it's not that one should argue that these people aren't racist. I mean, everybody's racist on some level, one could argue. But the point is, how do you talk to people who might be going to the ballot box and voting on issues other than racism? How do we adopt our language? How do we respond to when Steve Bannon says, I know that people react negatively to certain kinds of liberal language? Well, that doesn't mean we're ripping the rug out from under our, most consistent constituencies and changing policies in a way that's going to hurt marginalized groups. But it is saying, well, let's ask the question, is talking about white men and the way that we do, is saying, I heard this about Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is a white man. Therefore, What? You know, it was it was used as an epithet. Yeah. So, you know, never mind that Hillary Clinton was also white, you know, like, and how whiteness, you know, we need to analyze how we're using whiteness and identity as a weapon in a way that's defeating our own self-interest.
What about Basket of Deplorables? I mean, how harmful was that?
That was a real turning point for me, because it wasn't just that she said Basket of Deplorables. It was that she literally called a segment of the population irredeemable in that speech. Now, what does that mean for someone whose job as a politician is to reach out and appeal to, and then later to rule, to govern that population?
Linda, well, I know you want to say, go ahead, Linda.
That sounds so nice, but I just want to win, and the upper class white men, and to a much lesser extent, upper class white women, actually, if you look closely at the election statistics, upper-class white men have a rational, you're exactly correct, that this was not that different from a profile of the ordinary Republican Party. And upper-class white men have a rational interest in the policies of the Republican Party, deregulation, tax cuts, fighting the unions. The policies of the Republican Party serve upper-class white men very well. So as a political analyst, I would not look to them to change their minds, nor would I pitch my language or my policies to them. I sure would never say in public that they're deplorable. Let's not go there. But I think that you have to, it's like Willie Sutton said about the banks, you have to go to where the votes are. And I think the only chance of constructing an alliance that could win elections from the left or the Democratic Party involves appealing to people who have a real identity interest in the policies of the Democratic Party or the left.
Fair enough. Let me read a bunch of comments here. A tweet from Tobias. I'm not sure why we continue to buy into the narrative that identity politics and socioeconomic issues are distinct. Yes, class is an identity category, and so is white masculinity, for better or for worse. A tweet from Brittany. Republicans continue to indulge white supremacists around the country, but Democrats have a problem with identity politics? ! A tweet from ATP. Why does it have to be either or? Why not campaign on all the issues? Race, class, economy, education, and health care. I mean, that seems to be a simple solution, maybe not. Yeah. Imani Perry, and I mean, why do we, and perhaps I'm guilty of this as well, why did we divide it this way?
Yeah, you know, and I should say I'm not an expert in electoral politics, so I think I work a lot on race, so I'm not entirely sure, but I do think a word that you said earlier is relevant for this discussion, which is the word corporatist. I mean, you know, there are economic commitments of the Democratic Party as currently configured, at least the leadership of the Democratic Party currently configured, that look an awful lot like the traditional economic ideologies of the right wing of the Republican Party. I mean, this is why we talk about corporatism, we talk about neoliberalism, and there is a tension between those commitments, you know, to the big banks, to global elites, to various forms of, you know, of deregulation, even though there's some kinds of deregulation, they don't like the others, that they're very privatization. And so as a consequence, right, identity in some ways can act almost as a pretense that it doesn't actually get to talking about the conditions that lead to poverty, that lead to exclusion, et cetera, right? So I feel like that's sort of at the core of the tension around how far we can go politically at present, unless we demand something different.
Brianna, let me toss this to you, and we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation a couple minutes before our break here. But I was thinking about, you know, can you be a millionaire and be a lefty, a progressive. And I was also thinking about the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton, for all her faults, if she were president, we would probably still have DACA. The Affordable Care Act would not be under attack. There would be no travel ban. We would be still part of the Paris Accord, and I could go on from there. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger for liberals, for the Democratic Party, to sort of choose the perfect, if I can put it that way, over the good enough? Mm-hmm. Brianna?
I think that that is selling Democrats and the candidates that they could put forward short. I think the notion that the only option that the Democratic Party could put forward are those that are, you know, former prosecutors mm-hmm. and, you know, who have similarly, you know, distasteful looking records of taking money from the pharmaceutical industry, for example. You know, I think that that is pretending like we're in a world with more constrained choices than we actually are in order to justify a choice. And I think that the idea that race is used as a balm or as a shield to deflect criticism that's legitimate, is a real problem. I think that if you're interested in winning, you should be interested in doing the work now and in allowing us to vet these candidates now so that we don't end up in the exact same situation we were in 2016, where we were trying to, you know, make the best of a less than ideal situation. You know, I think it's a real misnomer to say there's nothing but a corporatist candidate. I think that the DNC has made a choice, mm-hmm. and it's using race to try to get us all on board.
Linda, I'm almost up on a break here, but let me give you 40 seconds to do a quick response, if you don't mind.
No, that's good. My response is I agree with that. I think we need to do our work now so that we don't get trapped in the kind of the class unveiling that went on with and attacking that went on with Hillary. I definitely think we need to do the work now. The other thing is that the unruly alliance that is the left and the Democratic Party, with all the good things you listed, is changing. And I actually am happy to see that. I think that the pressure from the Bernie Sanders campaign and stuff, even though I would have preferred to win the election in 2016, is, in my long abolitionist view, making the party change. The Clintons in the 90s changed the party. They brought it more to the corporatist model. So now there's a pushback, and I'm, you know, glad to see that. I hope that somebody finally turns their attention to reviving the labor union.
And that's Linda Hirschman, who joins us along with Imani Perry and Brianna Joy Gray. Another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Brianna Joy Gray. She's a lawyer, co-host of the SWOTY podcast. Also joining us, Linda Hirschman. She writes about social movements and has written a number of books and currently working on one about abolition. And Imani Perry, who's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, also working on some books as well. And I do want to play another clip. This is Bernie Sanders speaking at Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. And this is November 20th, obviously after the election, 2016.
As we fight to bring more and more women into the political process, Latinos, African Americans, Native Americans, all of that is enormously important. And count me in. If somebody wants to see that happen. But it is not good enough for somebody to say, hey, I'm a Latina, vote for me. That is not good enough. I have to know whether that Latina is going to stand up with the working class of this country and is going to take on big money interest.
Yep. So, Brianna, is Bernie Sanders the future of the Democratic Party? He has this Our Revolution, which is, and perhaps, you know, will create his own movement or party out of that.
Right. I mean, our revolution and Nina Turner, and I hope encourage other younger people to follow, you know, in his path. It's the same way I think it's pessimistic to think that the Democrats only have these limited options. I think that we have to dig a little deeper and look for alternatives that aren't just Bernie Sanders among the progressives. But certainly I think that it's a point of optimism.
A point of optimism that, I mean, yes, that he's there and he did as well as he did and clearly is ambitious for his message.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's difficult, especially this week with DACA, to talk about silver linings. And, you know, I don't want to be, you know, Susan Sarandon in all of this.
No, you don't want to be Susan Sarandon, but yes, go ahead, Rihanna.
But, you know, there is something to be said for the centrality of things like single payer to the national conversation in this kind of post-Bernie mm-hmm. world, and that we've gone from a place where we have our, you know, Democratic candidate saying single payer will never, ever happen, to every candidate now on the national stage having to, you know, either support express a desire for single payer, or come up with some justification for why they don't think it's feasible in the short term. But that the idea that that kind of a statement could be made here now today is, you know, anathema. And I think that that is some kind of progress.
Let me get Lou from Roxborough to join our conversation. And Lou, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. There he gets.
Hi, my name's Lou. I'm a Democratic ward leader and was a Bernie delegate, and I'm also a union official. And I like your comments, and I see these attacks on the Bernie progressive part of the party as a way that's really marginalized the progressive part of the party, so the people who have been in charge of these election debacles can still drive the bus. I know that if Bernie would have won and lost, it would have been 25 years before the left got back in the party. And I don't see it as like criticism. I see it as a concerted effort to marginalize, you know, the progressive part of the party. And by the way, I would love to be Susan Sarandon.
I think she's great personally.
Where you can go Susan Sarandon yourself there. No, thanks. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Then, Linda, let me give you a chance to weigh in on Lou's comment.
Well, you know, so, of course, he and I are on the same page about the labor unions, but in a sense, that's a symbol for me of people putting their economic interest, people on the bottom, as opposed to just the people on the top, putting their economic interest first. And that's a process, that bringing that back into the Democratic Party is a process I wish more than anything. I wish more than even turning into Susan Sarandon that the Democrats would have stations to sign up people for their renewed health care in every state and city in this country right now. Mm. When the abolitionists wanted to reach people, they went and rang their doorbells and asked them to sign petitions for abolition. And they talked to them about where their real interests lay. If the Democratic Party were really interested in a revival, they would take this current economic issue that benefits people of all colors and genders who need the health care, and they would say, we are here. We are here to help you sign up for health care.
Lou, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Imani, let me read an email from Art, who says, what Democrats must address if they ever want to win a presidential election, African Americans in particular, did not support Hillary Clinton. This is why she lost. Why this must be understood. I know you're not a pundit,
no,
per se, but does that resonate with you at all?
No. I mean, I you know, this is, it, in some ways, it goes back to
most African Americans did vote for her.
Right. And black women at the highest rate of anyone, I think. But this is, it goes to a point that Lou made. It goes to a point that we were discussing earlier. What's fascinating is who gets scapegoated in the aftermath of what's seen as a disastrous election. And that actually is very revealing about racial politics and class politics in our society generally. And the public is comfortable with blaming, right? So if we look at redistricting, as Linda talked about, if we look at voter suppression, I don't know how the consequence, how you read the situation is that this is, that the election of Donald Trump lays at the feet of black Americans. I think the election of Donald Trump lays more than anything at the feet of those who thought that he was an acceptable person to hold the office of the presidency. That seems to me to be just basic.
Not to mention the fact
Brianna,
that it was 53.
The Republican Party thought that. They nominated him. In
yes.
their very lengthy, very popular-driven, vote-driven process, they think that.
Yes.
So I think that the the issue is sort of recognizing, and actually the, as was it you, Brianna, or
no,
Imani,
it was me. Yeah.
Imani said, you know, this is like a base, your basic Republican Party.
Oh, no, that was Brianna.
Yeah,
I bet you were talking about, yeah.
Right. So we need to, it seems to me, recognize that there is a upper middle and upper class, elite-driven, mostly white, interest heavy population in this country that is going to offer working class white people a bargain that says, if you let us continue with this unequal economy, we will offer you the illusion of racial superiority. And that bargain's been going on since 1968. The Southern strategy.
Sure. I know you want to say something very quickly, Imani. Go ahead, and then I do want to get some more calls.
No, I do think, though, that there is a piece of that sort of a false consciousness narrative about white working class people voting against their interests, but there is actually material benefits that accrue to whiteness in the society, even for working class people. And that has to be addressed as well. And people know that. They know that there are costs to not being white and that, and want to preserve that.
That's right.
Yeah, hold on one second. And Brianna, I'll put this a caller to you. This is Robert calling us from Philadelphia. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hello.
Hi there.
My concern with the strategy of Hillary, and I had people in my house who are actually from Scranton, PA, who knew her and her family, who were lifetime Democrats who wouldn't vote for her, had a lot to do, I think, with her choice of Tim Kaine. I think she could have very easily brought the Bernie base on board with a more acceptable choice to that part of the community, and her failure to do that. I mean, Tim Kaine really did nothing, I could see, to fire up the Obama coalition in a meaningful way.
Robert, are you saying that she should have picked Bernie Sanders as her vice president?
Maybe Elizabeth Warren would have been a good choice, or someone that Bernie Sanders and his crew would have gladly supported and embraced, somebody out of the progressive tradition. Maybe the fellow from Minnesota, Keith DNC recently.
Sure.
Anybody but Tim Kaine. And really, honestly, what did Tim Kaine bring to the ticket?
Well, apparently not very much. Brianna, let me give you a chance to respond to Robert's comment.
Yeah, I think that's right. And for me, I think choosing Tim Kaine was really the final straw in terms of revealing how identity politics would only take you so far. Because remember, Tim Kaine is the one that supported the Hyde Amendment. Tim Kaine, you know, as governor of Virginia, was somebody who pursued abstinence-only education, who, you know, advocated for policies that would have, minors who were seeking abortions needing parental approval. And this is the candidate that this pro-woman, right, the candidate supposed to be best for women, is keeping at her side. And when I, as a Bernie supporter, raised this issue that as a woman who's interested in women's issues, I'm concerned that Hillary isn't the best candidate for women, I was called a Bernie bro.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, there was a lot of finger pointing and name calling. Unfortunately, let me read some more comments here. One, a comment from Sissy. She says, "I find it interesting that there are no male guests on the show today." A comment from Steve: "Can your guest comment on how effective Trump's refutation of political correctness is? It seems like the Democrats focus on language policing, alienating some sympathetic voters." I guess. Whether, and you have a puzzled look on your face, Imani. I don't know if anyone else does, but I guess this notion of political correctness driving people away because they can't say certain things. Do you think that's a key issue?
I think that that's a smokescreen of sorts or a red herring, right? Because I mean, really. You know, I mean, in some ways it's a holdover from the 90s, right? And the idea of speech codes and hate speech, and that somehow someone's rights are being threatened because it's no longer acceptable to use slurs or hateful speech or to be very assertive about some members of the society, the idea that they ought to be excluded, Right. And so what we see, I think Charlottesville is really instructive in the wake of Donald Trump, because it's a bold assertion of, and people, the way that people talk about it in terms of free speech, it's really about a bold assertion of white supremacist ideology, right? Mm-hmm. So, and there's so many other instances in which we say, well, these are not our values. Oh, but God protect free speech in this instance. When, in fact, when you look at who actually suffers from penalties based upon the expression of ideas, it's not the far right wing, for the most part.
So Linda. Brianna said something so beautiful in her piece about appropriation, mm-hmm. which is that the mistake or the transgression is to treat other people's cultural manifestations with disrespect. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And mm-hmm. whenever, I mean, as the white author of a book about a black and white movement abolition, whenever I hear someone say politically correct, I hear shut up. Mm-hmm. That's what I actually hear. Yeah. And I know that those of us who ask that people not say obnoxious things to us or treat us, as Brianna has it, with disrespect, are trying to make a place for ourselves as citizens in mm-hmm. the larger cultural society. So I reject that dog whistle of politically correct language. Can I just say that there absolutely, of course, there is a huge economic advantage to whiteness, and Brianna also touched on this in mm-hmm. her piece. And there is an economic advantage to being a man. Mm-hmm. So I get that totally. What I think needs to happen is that, and I think it's easy because it's true, white people need to, who have economic issues, need to be offered a benefit that is greater than the benefit that they get from their whiteness.
Hmm. What would that be?
That would be meaningful health care. That would be the ability to organize with the other people in your workplace to get both decent living conditions and the kind of respect that employers so rarely give to their employees when they are so powerless. That would be, I mean, this is easy. That would be genuinely progressive sure. income taxation. Sure. That would be the divorce of school systems from home ownership. Elizabeth Warren wrote about that. There are so many ways in which working class whites are trading the great advantages for the small advantage that their whiteness gives them. Boy, if we could attack anything, that would be my first choice.
I hear you. We're almost out of time here. Imani, I know you want to say something. I'm sure you do as well, mm-hmm. Brianna. Any final thoughts, Imani?
I was just to piggyback on Linda's point, one of the things that the language that I use for talking about that in my book is shifting the we, which is how do you engage in a cultural transformation in terms of organizing, not just in terms of electoral politics, but political organizing generally, in which you get people to see their conception of the we is not based upon a superior status to others, but actually kind of linked fate of those who are exploited or relatively vulnerable in the society.
And we is a very strong and powerful word. Brianna, final, you have 30 seconds. You get the last word.
I think that's right. And I do think, though, that that liberals need to take a close look at how we use language. Because out of Charleston, we had people saying, I'm not racist, and then marching in the streets about how the Jews are going to come and get us.
Right.
Right. So I think that we need to look about how effective it is to say things like, you are racist, and to use a language that is accusatory, rightly so. But if it's not effective, what's the point of telling people that they are mansplaining? What's the point of people of using this kind of jargon that is very useful to us when we're talking to people who are already a part of the choir, but is very alienating to those who, for better or for worse, feel like they're on the outs in society.
Well, I wish we had another hour. Brianna Joy Gray, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Linda Hirschman, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Imani Perry, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. In fact, carry on this conversation that we had on the radio. You can carry that on online. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.